Welcome to the Construction Industry Podcast. Fresh ideas for today's construction professional. The Construction Industry Podcast is brought to you by Remontech, Remote Monitoring Technologies. Find us on the web at constructionindustrypodcast.com.
Well, hello everybody. My name is Cesar Abade and I am your construction camera specialist. This is the 51st episode of the Construction Industry Podcast, a show dedicated to helping you navigate the waters of the construction industry. Whether you're starting your career, have been in the construction industry for years, or if you're a construction project owner or a construction business owner, there's always something new related to our beautiful industry we can all learn. Today, I speak with Anne Benny Wright and Jerry Ford on staying relevant and riding the change in the construction industry. Stay tuned. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome once again. It is another episode of the Construction Industry Podcast I'm proud to bring to you here today. It has been a few weeks, maybe a couple of months since the last episode, but the show keeps getting more and more subscribers. So if this is the first time you're listening or if this is the first new episode that you're listening, welcome. And if you'd like to connect with me, just go to constructionindustrypodcast.com. And you'll land on our website, and there you'll be able to contact me through the website and be able to also find all the previous 50 episodes of the show. Now, today I bring my conversation with Anne Benny Wright as we talk about her work with construction businesses. We talk about doing things differently, managing change and staying relevant, and adding true value to our clients and stakeholders in the construction industry. And after my chat with Anne, I also share with you a quick talk that I had with my friend Jerry Ford, who lives pretty close to me here in Canada. And we talk about some interesting initiatives that he is heading and also his take on networking on LinkedIn in the construction sector. So let's get started. Anne Benny Wright started in the construction industry in the marketing department of a building engineering firm. She worked her way up to chief strategy officer, started a national data center practice, ran the firm's national marketing organization, and finally ran operations for the West region of over 200 people and built a team to thrive through the Great Recession of 2008. With a marketing bent and years of operational experience, Anne brings a focus on differentiation and knows that strategies only happen if they become part of the operations of a company. Anne started Bright Operations LLC to help firms reach their greatest potential. Anne is immediate past president of the Southern California Development Forum, SCDF, current board member of ACE Mentor Program in Los Angeles, and past board member of the USC Architectural Guild. Anne is a past recipient of the SMPS Leonardo Award for Marketing Excellence.
And now, our feature segment.
Hello, Anne. How are you?
Great, Cesar. Thank you.
Good to talk to you. We've been we connected by email maybe a couple of months ago, and it's been going back and forth, and finally we are here.
I know. I love it.
From east to west, from That's Canada right. to the U.S. So, Anne, why don't you start by sharing with our audience here your story, you know, how you got started and how you got to be where you are today. I'd love to hear it.
Sure. I started a long time ago, I guess the best way to describe it. And in this industry, and what I mean by that is the architectural, engineering, and construction world, and really kind of fell in love with it. And I started out actually working for a firm called Siska Hennessy Group, and I did their marketing. I came in to help them sort of help their ailing Los Angeles office at the time. This was a million years ago. And then fast forward, I became a vice president of the company. And what was odd was I was not an engineer. I had a graphic communications background, but I got into really understanding what clients needed and listening to them and then helping the firm sort of figure out, well, what does that mean that they might have to do differently based on what the client's needs are? So I did that for a while. Then, you know, sort of fast forward, I was asked to do all these great things. I was asked to do turnarounds of offices for them. I was asked to start new businesses for them. So I ended up starting a their whole approach to the data center market. And so I got to, you know, get the people, and we just decided what our brand would be, and we became the most profitable group in the company. Had a blast doing that. I became their chief strategy officer, so I worked with all the people sort of on what the firm strategy should be. And after doing all of that, I thought to myself, gosh, you know, I could really be thinking about doing that for others. And right at that time, when I was just coming to my epiphany that I should be doing this for others, they had some turnover at the top leadership level. And so we adjusted to these leaders having left. And we, right before the big downturn, we redefined what our purpose and passion was. We called on clients we had gotten so busy we hadn't called. And we did all this stuff. And so all of a sudden now we're turning around an office and we're really great when the bottom fell out. And so if there was work, we got a lot of it. And consequently, when I decided to leave again, I felt I could leave a firm that I had worked with so hard for so many years, because in 2010, we had a 2-year backlog. So that's when I decided, okay, I can go help firms, you know, do turnarounds. I could go help firms start new businesses. I could go help leadership unite towards a common goal. And so that's what I've done in my business for the last 4 years and had a blast doing it. So was that too long-winded?
No, that's, if anything, I'd love some more details there. So how did you rise so fast? You know, from, you mentioned you're not an engineer, but like it was a bad thing, but how did that affect your career?
Well, you know what is, we were a wonderful partners in that I could not do what they could do. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't get bogged down in the day-to-day business because frankly, I couldn't. I mean, I couldn't worry about whether those drawings went out this afternoon, but I could worry a lot about what our competitors were doing, how we were distinctive, what our clients really wanted. So we were able to just stay ahead and be a lot more profitable because I wasn't so buried in the business. You know, most leaders are pulled in about 1,000 different directions. And though I always felt like my hair was on fire, I was still able to have our group see the client first. And that, I think, made a huge difference. And so I think we were a great combination in working together.
I see. Cool. So so what kind of clients do you work for today?
You know, I work for architects and engineers, project management companies, and contractors. And what's really fun, I mean, what's fun for that is that's the whole Megillah. That's everybody involved, not everybody involved in a project, but the whole cycle. You know, who hands off to whom, who leads, that kind of thing. So I see it from about a million perspectives, which is great. And also I work for really big companies like Jones Lang LaSalle or HOK or Clark Construction, or I'll work for small 15-person shops and some in between. So my optics about the industry have completely expanded from even when I was running a 150-person office. You know, you think you see it all, and then you get out into the industry on your own, and you just, it's like doors open to the possibility, to the changes, to the heartache, to all of that. So it's been a really fun ride.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. So you get to see, you know, all aspects from the, of the industry from all different perspectives.
Yeah.
That's really cool. In my day, you know, my 9-to-5, I get to see a little bit of that, but maybe not in, you know, in the same, with the same impact that you have. But, it's very interesting to see how, people sometimes even working on the same project will look at it so differently.
Isn't that crazy? The other thing is that's fun about my role is I get to hear people's struggles. And what's interesting is that most people are struggling with the same thing with just a little bit of a different twist to it. I guess a good way to describe it is, you know, there's this huge trend and word called collaboration that everybody uses.
Right.
And as the most common, the most common evidence of people trying to collaborate is that they're nice to one another. But no one has learned how 1 + 1 = 3. Collaboration simply means I have a good relationship with the architect, or I have a good relationship with the contractor. And that usually means we work together, we're polite, we, you know, meet our dates that we say that we'll meet. But the collaboration has, we've not even scratched the surface on what real collaboration can be. And so I'm watching it from the contractor trying and the architect trying and the engineer trying. I just like, oh my gosh, if you really look at this from above, it's like a calamity. Everybody's trying, but not to the, I think a lot of people don't have the skills to do it.
Mm-hmm. So maybe a little bit more specific. So let's say you are brought into a project and you are, let's say, working with a contractor. So mm-hmm. what is exactly that you do, let's say, for a contractor on a big project?
Well, my work is not project related. My work is much more about how could they strengthen their business? How could they strengthen their distinction in the marketplace from one contract to another? How could they, you know, what is the market's impression of them? And all of those kind of things. And how does their leadership unite in a vision of what their possibility is, and who are the kind of clients they really want to work for, and who do they work best with, and what turns on their people, and what can attract people, you know, employees to a firm. It's those kind of things that I work with, not project related, mm-hmm. so to speak.
So let's say with a contractor, you know, my experience with working with contractors in particular is they are in a very stressful position, because they usually are the low bidders. Mm-hmm. And they have very little wiggle room for any type of, let's say, expense that's not directly related to a project they're working on. So how do you approach contractors, for example, and sell them on the idea that they actually need, I agree with you, it's needed, you know, you need to differentiate yourself, you need to do better in business, but yeah. How do you approach them and what is the success rate that you have?
Most of my contractors are not low bid contractor. They're negotiated bid contractors. Mm-hmm. They I've been blessed with having been in the industry so long, I rarely compete. People knew me and I had called on them and they liked what I had done and they had watched what I had done. And so the only time I compete is when I get a sort of out of the blue call, like, oh, you know, we called this firm, or we called this, you know, professional society and they recommended you. And now all of a sudden it's like, oh God, it's hard to come up to speed to get in their brain about what they need, you know? So that's really the only time I compete. I feel very blessed in that way, but usually they're coming to me, but what I try and explain to people is that the past of being individual contributors, a whole firm of people that are sort of individual contributors, is really, really the old days. And I would take any firm where people worked together within the firm, to be smarter over one genius. I would take the three that work together who are not as smart any day over the one smart guy. And it used to be that everybody got to just be good. If they were good and really great with the client individually, that was enough. And it's not. I talked about collaboration a minute ago. People are better at collaborating internally than they are, what I was referring to before was collaborating externally. like how an architect would collaborate with a contractor or an engineer would collaborate with subs, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So let's talk about changes then in the industry. I was recently at a meeting of the Construction Owners Association of America.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if you're familiar with the organization. They're just fantastic. And it was a very good conversation about changes and how difficult it is to implement changes and how resistant the industry is to change. But change is coming and it needs to come, especially when it comes to, I think the, one of the issues was, what is the word I'm looking for? Efficiency. In which is not only stagnant, but it seems like it's actually getting worse when every other industry it's skyrocketed in the last 20 years. So let's talk about changes a little bit. What kind of changes do you see happening right now in the construction industry?
Well, I don't know the exact figures on this, but I remember a couple years ago I was studying a big report that came out, and it talked about innovation, and it talked about productivity gains. And it is so clear that our industry, of all industries, are so far behind, and that the gains that we used to get in the construction and engineering world were more efficiency gains than innovation gains. And what efficiency has done is just made us all work harder and not necessarily smarter. And what other industries have done is that they've innovated and become higher value. And so one of the things that I'm really noticing come up with clients, not my clients, but the owner clients, is they are no longer willing to pay for the way it's always been done. They are really looking at only paying for value. So you look at our industry of the way that we had typically done design, bid, build, where you design a project and then you give it to a contractor or people to cost, and they come back and go, oh my God, that's way over what it should be. And then everybody redesigns it, and then they try and then they value engineer a lot of what they'd already designed in, and then they come up with something that'll work for everybody, and then they take the drawings that were already done, and then the subcontractor redraws the draw. I mean, it was like if you drew it, you'd start laughing.
Yeah,
it was such a bad plan. And now clients are kind of saying, not willing to pay you what we've always paid you, because it's not, why are there two sets of drawings all the time? Why is there the design drawings and then the fabrication drawings? Why, you know, what really adds value? And so people are really challenged with, what is it I do that is of the greatest value to a client? What is it I do? So in other words, if you were to just sort of draw a line in the air right in front of you, a horizontal line, and looked at that line as sort of what people have always done, and you were to look at every step of your process on that line, and you would say, what of these steps really, really, really adds value to clients? And of those steps, convince yourself that you're going to go way above that horizontal line on that step because it's so valuable to them. Then you look at your other steps and you go, okay, well, nobody cares about that second step, yet we've been doing it that way for 100 years. I'm going to do way less than everybody else does on that step. I'm going to just do what's needed. I'm not going to, you know, do what everybody else does. I'll give you an example of this whole thing, but people have to start looking at not the way they've always done it, but what adds value. So I just heard about a firm, an architectural firm. One of my clients was in a position to be helping select, they were almost like an owner's rep where they were helping the owners review conceptual design packages from a series of architects. And they're reading these things, and my architect client said, oh my God, and one of them was so good. It was 3 pages long. It wasn't 40 pages long. It was completely inspired and innovative. There were no drawings associated with it. There was no boilerplate in it. They clearly got huge brains in the room to come up with such a inspired concept. And my client said, and the next week I had to do conceptual design submission, and I couldn't get my team or me to do it differently. And this person was comparing it to the one that they saw, and he goes, and when I thought about what this firm had done, they probably didn't waste a whole bunch of time doing drawings that no one would read. They might have done, I don't recall whether they did sketches or not, but any kind of visual that was added was completely helpful and not just filler. And they said they probably were able to charge less for this, to win the job. They probably were able to charge less. They probably made more money because they didn't do wasted efforts. And frankly, their result was better than everybody else's.
Hmm.
And it was such an eye-opener to me in two ways. One was, if you don't put in the boilerplate, how long is your report? And two was that how this client of mine was able to see it, appreciate it, and it's so hard to change that they went back to do it the way they've always done it. I thought that was real. And now, in that person's defense, it was a time frame and they would have to get their team to operate differently, blah, blah. And I think that they're taking it down now to do it differently. But I thought, well, that is really interesting. So a big part about change is, are you willing to look at what you do, and are you willing to really evaluate it in terms of the value it brings, what decisions that people can make from it, what people's next steps are, or is it just what I've always done, and 10 of those pages aren't really that valuable, but they prove that I'm valuable because there's a lot of information there, whether mm-hmm. they kind of need that information or not.
Yeah.
So that's a big change, because I think clients are going to drive it by not be willing to pay, because I haven't seen fees, skyrocketing up with how busy everybody is. Yeah. I'm not seeing that.
No. Okay. So how can people, get on board with the change? Because from my perspective, it's so hard to keep up with work, sometimes, and keep your costs down. So how can people go about not only keeping up with change, but also innovating to the point that they make such a good impression on a client like that?
Well, I think because I am working with with one engineering firm right now who's looking at this, and an architect that's looking at it, and we're literally listening to clients, and we're coming up with, from the engineer's point of view, where they think their value is greatest, and we're having meetings with clients to have them say, yeah, not so much. Like, we want to ask questions like, what can we give you that would be best in order for you to make a decision? I've read reports where I can't tell what the decision we're asking the client to make from this report. And I don't even know what their next step is supposed to be. So, how can we interact with some clients to really understand that value thing and take the time to step back and say, what if for a schematic design package, what if instead of what everybody normally gets for it, and let's say, let's just call it X, let's say the going rate is around X. And what if I were to say to someone, okay, instead of X, I want you to give it to me for 3/4 of X. How can you beat the value for less money? And you'd really say, well, then I can't do those dumb drawings. And then I can't do this and that. Well, okay, so how do you cull out the really important things? because, you know, it's not about hours. It's about value. And I think if people start asking questions and really looking what they do, they will be, I just thought of another story that just happened. An architect was meeting with their client and they wanted to ask for additional fees for some ad services. And it really wasn't ad services. It was more hours spent. And the guy brought his logbook of hours, which is never a good idea. And he went to the client and he goes, look at how many hours I spent on this. And the client was gracious enough to say, you know, I'm going to take off my client hat and I'm going to put on my, I'm a huge fan and a friend of yours hat. I don't care that you spent that many hours. You spent too many hours because I'm not seeing the difference and I'm not willing to pay for that. And the guy totally understood. I mean, the architect that had brought his hours, it was like a huge aha for him. I was busy spending 80% more time making it 20% better, and that 20% is probably only stuff I'll see and notice.
Yeah.
And he said to me, oh my God, Anne, it was such a huge awakening, you know, on how I have to change how I work. So, and those are just some of the changes that are happening. There's all sorts of, you know, things going on with design build and how you work with others and the hierarchy that people are so used to in terms of the who's leading the project is, you know, sometimes it's the architect, sometimes it's the contractor. And I think sometimes the engineers feel that because of that hierarchy, they don't often get to say, geez, we're spending too much time on this effort of this particular, we need to do it differently. So I think people are just being traumatized with the change they need to do because they've been able to be sort of the lone expert. And it's fun to watch what can happen when a team really gets the best out of everybody. And people are all trying to figure out how to do it.
Mm-hmm. So is this something that you can help clients with, you know, how to look at things differently and provide more value with less effort?
Yeah. Yes. And I'm having a blast doing it. Uh-huh. And we're challenging just about our every step. I remember at my old firm that our management always used to say to us, if you could just grow 8 to 10% next year, that would be great. And I always wondered what would happen if they said you had to grow 30% next year. And I don't mean that, and what I'm trying to get at is, then I think people would look at how they had to do things differently in order to grow profits by 30%, as opposed to, I'll just run faster. Nice. I'll just do this, or I won't pay the people as much, or I'll make them work longer hours, or I'll do. I mean, it's like the same dang thing. And I think people are exhausted from trying to run that fast. So when you stop and sit back and say, gosh, maybe some of the stuff I do isn't adding the value it needs to. So how do I crystallize where that is? And that's what I am helping people do. And hopefully we can put the fires out a little bit more and allow them to do what they can really do best.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. This is, you know, we're in the industry and this is it's almost like a mindset shift that you need. Typically this is, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but what I see is we are good at doing something a certain way. And then when we're thinking about growth and increasing revenue, we think, okay, how can I do this more often? How can I do more of this? Or how can I get the message out that I do this, you know, marketing. Mm-hmm. And so so how can I do more of this and therefore make some more money, some unknown amount of money, you know? as opposed to, okay, if I, let's set a goal of growth, as you said, 30%, and then look, let's crunch the numbers. Well, that means that I need to be making this much per year next year. How and reverse engineer that number and say, okay, how can I be making that? And then you realize, okay, well, I need to deliver more value because, you know.
Because it can't just come from me running faster.
Right. And yeah. And oh, I can hire another one of me, but then my costs go up too.
So, yeah.
So how do I do this differently, or how can I do different things that add more value to the clients so I can get to charge more without having to spend more?
Yeah, because the value would be so great.
Right.
You know, a little, another nugget of this is I was on a panel with a gentleman who was from a, I don't want to say the corporation, from a large medical service provider. And he was saying something very interesting about the whole process that we're in. But what he said was, right now, and he was talking about design engineers, he says, right now, design engineers are so focused on producing work, on producing drawings, that I don't get the best of their brain. And our projects need the best of their brain. And by the best of their brain, they need to know a lot about energy modeling, and they need to know a lot about unique, innovative ways to do what they do. But, you know, as soon as they figure out something they can do or draw, that's where they spend their time.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that in their organization about 2 years ago, they said that they hope that the industry will figure out that engineers have a lot more value to bring in their brain, and that subcontractors do production a lot better than they do. So they even said that they hoped that the generation X and Y, you know, as opposed to the millennials, they said that Gen X and Y would be the last one that engineers train doing, companies train engineers doing production, and that millennials will hopefully be taught to use their brain more and add more value from their brain than through the doing.
Mm-hmm.
Which
yeah.
is really crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really exciting from the standpoint of, okay, you want to cut out waste? That would be a good place and get more value, but that's not how firms are set up. So it would be so disruptive because a lot of the producers would have to leave the engineering firm and go to the contractor.
Mm-hmm.
But the value of those people that know how to get in a client's head and really get innovative from a technical standpoint, oh my God, but they're too focused on getting the drawing done.
Right.
So that someone could then redo it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a shift from being a technician to being a value adder, I guess, and that's the thing. Like you know, doing drawings, that is something that anybody can train and do, and it becomes a commodity. And then when you become a commodity, then it's a race to the bottom when it comes to pricing, and
yeah.
You know, you can't win that way, right?
You know, it's funny. I was listening to a radio program that the Wharton School puts on today in the car. And I was thinking about you and having this conversation. They were how in healthcare that the new buildings and facilities are sort of being pressed into having to be sort of almost like resorts where there's a big sort of comfort and relaxation that's good for healing, but also high amenity. And they were saying that it used to be that if you had a liver problem, you would find the best liver doctor or surgeon or whatever the heck it would be, and you would go to that person, and you wouldn't care if there was giant fluorescent lights and you were sitting there because you got to see this particular doctor. Well, our healthcare has improved so much that it isn't as much, where is that best liver doctor? You're thinking I could go to Cedars. This is out in California, but you could go, I'm sure in your local area, if you're in a big city, you could name 5 hospitals that you'd feel comfortable going to. to get care, so that the specific expertise of the doctor is replicated by maybe 5 or 10 others. So now all of a sudden, healthcare, for many reasons, including Obamacare and other things, are having to sort of retrench. And now how do I attract people? And a lot of it now has to do with the facility. So welcome to commodity.
Yeah.
You know, if that's where the doctor's getting to,
yeah,
in terms of what they do. And I thought that was, you know, a great analogy to, you know, what's happening in a lot of industries.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, the more sophisticated we become, the more standardized we seem to become as well. So, mm-hmm. You know, I was just having this discussion with my dad, who's a civil engineer. Mm-hmm. And he was thinking about this a couple of years ago. He wanted to build a deck in the back of his house. And mm-hmm. I mean, he has a master's degree in structures, and he could design that deck so it would be structurally sound and beautiful and all that. And you uh-huh. know. So let's say he would come to the conclusion that the beams would be this many inches apart.
Right.
And that to save materials and stuff. But then you go and you have to comply with code. And
yeah.
the code says that the beams need to be this many inches apart. And
yeah.
and so there goes your work. So now anybody can build a deck. And it's going to cost the same. It's going to cost more than it should.
Right.
And but the knowledge of how to build that became a commodity, because it's not necessary, because you need to comply with the code. And he's like,
and there goes the brain work.
There goes the brain work, you know.
Yeah.
So and it's and the yeah. You know, so how do you get over that, right?
Right, exactly. And well, I think you've got to come up with, where are those value spots? You know, we amusingly, and I won't bore you, but we had the same problem with our deck. Kind of a funny thing, but all right. So, well, I think where the emphasis has to be is, it is not going to be done by doing what we already do, same old stuff, just faster. That I know is not the answer.
Mm-hmm.
So a little bit off the topic, but I think interesting, is I heard a or I have a video watching the woman who used to be in charge of I'm struggling on the name. Citizen scientists.
Okay.
And they figured out these crazy huge problems and posted them on websites that were with scientists from all over the world, and even like college science people. And they spent a lot of time defining a problem, and they set it out there, and in like a week, they had some of the best solutions to the problems that they have ever seen. And I keep thinking, wow, how bizarre is it that we can now tap expertise from around the world by asking the question, and that so many people are interested in that. And I keep wondering in my own brain how our industry can use that, and I don't know. I don't know the answer, but you know, I know that to be able to accelerate and surface great ideas faster would be good. But and I'm figuring, if they can do it in the scientific community, why couldn't we do it in ours? But I that's my latest, is gosh, how would you apply some of that idea to our industry?
Mm-hmm.
And our next talk, Caesar, someday we'll have that chat.
Very good. No, you're welcome whenever, you know, at any time. This is a fascinating conversation. And so I also think that because of the new generation that's coming in, and I don't know if you've noticed this, but I think there's a big gap. I feel that there's more people retiring than actually joining the ranks, yeah. young people. So, but I think it's inevitable that there's going to be this, you know, especially the millennials, so with their
mm-hmm.
their way of thinking, and there's going to be a big shift. And I think even for the listener right now, even if you feel you are a bit trapped by the by the system. Let's say you work for government and you have to do things a certain way. And I think it pays off. It's going to pay off to start thinking about these things right now, because when the shift comes, you're going to be ready and you're going to be in the forefront. So right now it doesn't take much to stand out. So I don't know if you agree with me, Anne, but I think it's a good thing to start thinking about innovation and how to ride the wave of change, because it is coming.
Well, you know, the one thing that I would say is I heard people talking that right now there are four different generations in the workplace.
That's true.
Which is crazy. And we have to sort of figure out that. And that by 2020, which is, as you know, not too far away, 75% of the workplace will be millennials. I mean, that is just an incredible thing to think about. Yeah. And if we think about millennials as being those people that work to passion, and you think that there's a talent shortage in the architectural engineering and construction because so many people fleed it, you know, during the downturn.
Yeah.
I can't imagine us not figuring out where people's brains and abilities are best used. So if an engineer's best abilities are in one spot, we should be figuring out what that spot is, and that's what they should be doing. And if a subcontractor's better at another, I don't think there's enough people around to have such duplication. So I think the millennial situation will only accelerate the changes that are happening, which is a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And if our industry is not exciting and innovative and you know, and fueled by passion, then it's not going to be attractive to new workers, especially the newer generations who are used to, you know, growing up in exciting times and making a difference in whatever they do. Mm-hmm. I feel like sometimes it's really hard for you to make a difference in a construction project, because things are dictated and you need to do it this way, and you know, better do it, or you know. So yeah, I think if the change doesn't come from within, it's going to come from the outside, because we're going to have to figure out a way to attract people into the industry.
Yeah.
And the only way to do that, I think, in the future is to make it exciting and have people be able to make a difference. And that means innovation, flexibility, and all those things.
Yeah. And being able to see their contribution to what just happened. I mean, into this building or into facilitating the collaboration that is so important and so elusive to so many. It's a real exciting time, I'll have to say.
Yeah, and you know, and I think we kind of lost a little bit of that. And I was just talking on the show with another guy, I can't remember, it was, I don't know, like maybe 2 years ago, about this, the fact that, let's say back in the 30s and 40s, and somebody worked, like my grandpa, for example, if you worked on a construction site of a building, he'd be proud of it. You know, he'd be talking about that thing for years. Oh, you know, I worked on that project.
Yeah.
I just don't see much of that anymore. It's like, okay, you build that and then you move on to the next and you forget about it because it's all the same. And it's forgettable.
You know, you're bringing up that a really good thing that I hadn't thought about, which is that whole thing of things are so almost regulated that you can only do it in a certain way.
Yeah.
And, that's a very interesting part. I think there's also the element of not just regulated in a certain way, but I'm moving too fast to be able to think about how I would be doing it different.
Right.
And that is from years of just wringing out every minute of efficiency of a project. And I don't mean efficient in terms of what's needed. I only mean efficient in doing what we've always done. Mm-hmm. And that has people running so fast. It's like, oh my God, I'm already working 10 hours a day. When am I supposed to plan my new approach?
Right.
And until you force yourself to do it and work with the team who's willing to kind of do it, you'll be singing the same old tune. And we'll be singing it in 2017 and 2019. So it's time to really look at where we add value and add passion and put ourselves to do just that.
I couldn't agree more. And this has been fascinating. I think we could go on for hours here. This is really cool, really cool conversation. I'd love to have you back on the show at another time, maybe to talk about this from another angle. And if people want to learn more about you and what you do, where should they go?
My website is brightoperations.com, bright like shiny, and operations, plural.com. And I have a blog just to kind of wake people up a little bit that they could sign up for, and I'd love to hear from them.
I subscribe to your blog, and I just, there's a very interesting, the latest blog post there is about how women are naturally better leaders than men. And I'm just going to leave it at that. If you want to learn why, you just go to Anne's blog, and I'll have the link to the blog and to the website on the show notes for today's episode. And thank you so much for your time and sharing your expertise and your insights with the audience here. Thank you so much.
My great pleasure.
All right. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Anne. And be sure to check out the show notes for today's episode at constructionindustrypodcast.com. Or if you go to remontech.com/51, it'll take you straight to the show notes. Now, let me introduce you my friend Gerald Ford, or Jerry, as he's known by his friends. Jerry has worked for over 75 different organizations and businesses. 75 organizations and businesses. He's a graduate of Western University, like myself, Wilfrid Laurier University, and the University of Guelph. Jerry also taught at Conestoga College for 16 years, covering a wide range of courses, including supply chain, human resources, information technology, and management development. Jerry's company, Cambridge Solutions, was founded in 1993 after he left IBM Canada. Cambridge Solutions, Inc., or CSI, is dedicated to tackling interesting projects that provide their clients with creative supply chain, spend, and performance management solutions. Part of their goal is to also help provide opportunities for today's youth, including a new initiative in Qingdao, China. Hello, Jerry. How are you?
I am absolutely fantastic.
Jerry, you and I are here in the same corner of Canada, and we just met a couple months ago. I was driving by your hometown, and I stopped by. We had I think we had some coffee, and we talked about construction and business, and I thought it'd be great to bring you onto the Construction Industry Podcast to tell my audience and the listener a little bit about what you do and some of the initiatives that, one initiative in particular that you're involved with that is really interesting. So why don't you tell us a little bit about you and what you do?
Okay. So thank you very much, Caesar, for hosting this and allowing me to be able to participate. So my background is I'm a supply individual with a number of different contacts. I formed Cambridge Solutions in 1993 with a goal of helping organizations improve their process. And since then, I've been involved with over 70 different companies. So our goal is to be able to enjoy what we do and to get involved in some special projects, which we're going to talk about.
Cool. And when we sat down, we talked about a lot of things, you know, different things that you're doing, and as well as different things that I'm doing. And I think a perfect thing to bring up here is you're looking for a Few Good Projects initiative. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what that entails?
So this got started a little while ago because I was involved with Conestoga College, and I would be working with the students, and I would be asking where they got their inspiration for certain projects they had to work on in order to graduate. And some of them said, you know what, I made it up myself, or, you know, I had to beg and borrow. So the college actually approached me and said, you know, would I give them a hand to find industry sponsors for what is a international business management program. And I said, sure, I think it's a great opportunity to be able to take these excellent resources, which are students at a college level that are doing a degree program, and put them together with some industry partners who, for one reason or another, can't seem to get any traction on certain projects that they'd love to be able to do, but just don't have the time or the energy or the money to be able to do it.
Yeah, it sounds like a win-win-win. Win for the student, win for the company, and also win for the educational institution, and for you as well, right?
I think it's great. It's a form of soft marketing for us. We've got 16 projects that we've actually launched this particular time around, and there's some brand name organizations that are participating, both big and small, some in the food industries. It's really a nice cross-section of organizations, and we've got even one from Montreal.
Mm-hmm. So not just construction, correct?
Not just construction. What we want to be able to do is, as long as it has a supply chain, human resources, and then next year a marketing or finance perspective to it, those are all absolutely fantastic. There's a committee that reviews them. I'm usually the first one who says, yeah, it probably will make the cut, and then it's reviewed by two of the college professors and the chair of the School of Business.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think you are in a special position to be able to help in it with an initiative like this because of your extensive network. Tell us a little bit about that, and maybe can you give us a tip or two on how to network better?
I've out of the 16 projects, 11 came from my own network. So what I've been doing over a number of years is just adding individuals that I have an affinity for. So lately what I've been doing is I've been connecting with a whole bunch of people that have a supply chain designation, not necessarily to do business, but to basically share information and share opportunities with others and to be able to, pay it forward, pay it back kind of thing. And I've also been heavily involved in a number of different professional associations, so that helps to build a network. I'm a really strong advocate of LinkedIn. I don't have the premium version, so everything I do on LinkedIn is we're using the free version. But it's one of those things that I think if more and more businesses just looked at it as a soft marketing tool, they would get a huge amount of value out of it.
Mm-hmm. So what do you do? So let's say you logged into LinkedIn and you're looking to make some new connections. So what do you do?
Well, right now, I'll give you a perfect example. Right now, I'm looking for individuals who are in the food industry or looking for individuals who are in the construction industry. Then what I do is I take a look and see if they are a graduate of Conestoga College or Wilfrid Laurier or another school that I went to. Then what I do is LinkedIn has the ability to be able to tell you how many different people you're connected to and how many similar people. So, for instance, I saw one individual that I'd never met before, but we had 89 connections in common. So the chances of us having similar perspectives is quite strong. So LinkedIn has the ability to be able to customize your quest to connect. So what I do is I type something in along the lines of, I see that we've got 89 or 102 connections in common. I think this would be a great opportunity for connect, and who knows how we might be able to help each other in the future. And I use, and most of the time people say, yeah, this is a really good idea, because they can see that, we've got some similarities where other people are using it as a cold calling or a spam tool, and that's the wrong reason for using LinkedIn.
Mm-hmm. In fact, that's how we met. We met through a common connection. And one thing that turns me off a little bit on LinkedIn is when people connect with you out of the blue, or maybe someone from your past, and it sounds like they're looking to reconnect and all that, and then after a few messages back and forth, they go, oh yeah, I'm looking for a job, It seemed, and to me, it's like, oh, okay, so basically you're trying to connect with me because you need something,
Yep.
So what you're saying is just always be connecting, especially when you don't need anything, but just for the, offering to help and offering value to the potential new connection without having to, be asking for anything in return. Is that correct?
That is correct. There's an individual I worked with last night, and we looked at his profile, and I said, first of all, put your picture up there, because not having a picture, I don't know who you are. indicate a little bit more of what you've done. So tell me what projects you've worked on. And then make sure that you're very careful on when you update. And if you really want to connect with somebody for that particular purpose, which is looking for a job, put it in. Because LinkedIn allows you to indicate a reason why you want to connect. So put it in. Be upfront about it.
Yeah.
I get people who request a link with me, and I take a look and I go, hold a second, I don't know them. I don't see why they want to connect with me. So I'll send a little note back to them saying, why do you want to connect? And 99% of the time, I never get an answer back. So then I just delete.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I have an open door policy when it comes to LinkedIn, but... That's a good approach as well, to, because at the very least, I start some communication as well, some conversation, and start building relationship when they do reply, right?
Yeah, I actually am a firm believer of doing a lot of networking. So I actually donate my time to speak to various associations and groups. So if there's a group out there that's listening to this and would like me to come to visit them, as long as it's not too far or they cover the expense to get there, I can share in an hour some of the hints and tips that I use to increase my network. And like last week, I think I got close to 60 new connections.
Wow. Yeah, I recommend for the listener to connect with Jerry, because not only you're a great networker, and you can talk about the looking for a few good projects initiative, but from my conversations with you, you have a lot going on, a lot of different, very interesting initiatives, and it all involves connecting with people, bringing people together in a room for events and things like that. So I really recommend to the listener to connect with you through LinkedIn, and I'll have a link to your LinkedIn profile on the show notes for today's episode. Now, Jerry, if people want to learn more about you and about the Looking for a Few Good Projects initiative, where should they go?
Right now, we haven't put anything on our website because we're still in kind of what I would call prototype stage. I am a believer that, open communication. So I have no problems posting my contact information and people can actually approach me directly. It doesn't take very long for me to be able to respond if there is an honest interest in what we're working on. I also know that, there's times where what we're working on is not appropriate for a group because it's just outside the scope or that, and I'm very quick to be able to come back to people and say, sorry, it's not a fit because the students aren't the right students. But we're also looking at expanding this program to two other areas, one in information technology and another one most likely in the food safety area. So there's lots of new stuff that's coming in 2015, which is going to be extremely exciting.
Okay. And so your LinkedIn page is better than your website. Is that what you're saying?
I think the LinkedIn page at this point is better. And what I do is that if people are connected with me, I post when I'm looking for these kinds of things. So my LinkedIn fans will be the first ones to see what's happening. But I also do, a little bit of Twitter and a little bit of Facebook because, again, there's different people that follow depending on the method of social media.
Very good. And again, I'll have a link to your profile on the show notes for this episode, which the listener can find at constructionindustrypodcast.com, and look for today's episode there. Jerry, thank you so much for your time. And maybe next time I'm driving by Guelph, I can stop by again and we can continue our conversation.
You for sure are invited to come and visit and spend some time, and hopefully this will be one of many future conversations.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you, Caesar.
All right, my friends, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Jerry and also my conversation with Anne Benning-Wright. And it's great to be back here and then produce another episode of the show. A lot has happened since last time I was here, and I'd like to tell you that my book, which I believe I shared with you guys last time, called Project Management for You, is now being edited. I've been going back and forth with the editor right now, right today. It's I'm finishing reviewing one of his edits, and it should be out to print within the next couple of months. So if you'd like to pre-order the book, and by the way, the book is called Project Management for You. The subtitle is How to Turn Ideas into Reality, Deliver on Your Promises, and Getting Things Done. And basically, I introduced the concept of project management to the rest of us, people who are not necessarily project managers, how they can use some of the tools and techniques and the mindset of project management so they can turn their ideas into reality as well. I've been getting some feedback from some folks that have had a little bit of a preview of a few chapters, so I'm excited about that. If you'd like to pre-order this book, you can go to projectmanagementforyou.com. Again, projectmanagementforyou.com, and I'll add a link to this on the show notes for today's episode as well. So if you go to constructionindustrypodcast.com and look for episode 51, you'll be able to see the link there. And really, this is what I had for you today. I hope you enjoyed this conversation here ahead with my guests today. And I thank you for subscribing to the Construction Industry Podcast. And before I go, if you are a part of the construction project and you'd like to, you've thought about having maybe having cameras so you can have a live feed of your construction project on the web, or if you'd like to have a time-lapse recording of your job site, or if you'd like to see how we can link the time-lapse recording that we create to the Gantt chart of your project, check out what we do. Go to constructionindustrypodcast.com and you will land there on the podcast website, which is part of my company's website, which is remontech.com, remote monitoring technologies. We've been doing this for over 10 years now, and we've had projects all over the Americas and all across the US and Canada, South America as well, and you see what we can do. So go to constructionindustrypodcast.com, check out what we do, and get in touch with me. We'd love to participate and collaborate on your next project. So that's it, my friends. I will talk to you again next time. Thank you for listening, and until episode 52. Bye-bye.